Well, you know how I feel about this time of day. It's time for Arthur Schwartz, the food maverick, food maven, anyway. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, how are you, Jill?
I'm quoting my dad here because he used to always say this, and like, how are you? I can't complain.
I can't. I say that all the time.
Do you?
I can't complain, although I do.
And then I add, although I do. And it's like, why not? You do. You know, it's so easy. But, yeah, I can't complain. Or I'll just accurately say.
Italian, and I say this to my doorman because he speaks Italian, non c'è male means not so bad.
Not so bad. Non c'è male.
Anyway, I'm actually good this morning. I have been, since I got back from my voyage. I have been roasting chickens because I have this thing, if I eat something out and it's not good, I have to go home and cook it good. So it took me maybe a day to figure out how on the ship they managed to overcook the chicken without browning the skin.
And how did they?
Pardon me?
Inquiring minds, how did they manage
that? I'm sure it was microwaved. I'm sure they like half cooked it and then finished it.
Oh,
I don't know. That was my best guess.
Okay.
It was also not a very good chicken. So I got home, and in fact, I have not had a chance to go to the market that sells the branded, you know, chicken is now branded. So even though I go to the butcher, it's a Bell and Evans chicken. I mean, he'll tell you that. He won't hide it. Anyway, I've been experimenting with different chickens, and I must say there are big differences in chickens. So the first thing about making a roast chicken is buying a good chicken. And I have been known to go to the live poultry stores here in Brooklyn and get a freshly killed chicken. But you cannot cook a freshly killed chicken. You need to let it sit in the refrigerator for a couple of days to get out of rigor mortis before you can cook it and the meat is tender.
Right.
I don't actually go to the live poultry places for a small chicken, for your 3 to 4 pound chicken. I go there when I want to make a big, big pot of soup, and there's nothing like a big old hen for soup. It's just different. It tastes different.
One of my,
smells different. Pardon me?
I said one of my favorite, you know, it's almost like a different universe. But one of my favorite pictures in a cooking magazine from some time ago, a well-known one, was a babushka grandma with the hen under the hen under her arm and the vegetables in her her basket.
Anyway, I just saw online somebody else complain that there are no more 3 pound chickens in the world. I did order a chicken from my butcher last week, and I said, please give me the smallest bird you have, and that ended up to be 4 pounds. So there are some weeks I know I can get a 3.5 pound one, but that's about as small as they get. When I first started writing about food, our chickens, meaning in America, in the Northeast anyway, chickens weighed about 2.5 pounds. 3 pounds was already a big chicken. So, and by the way, age is not a factor here. All chickens, small and larger, are slaughtered at between 7 and 10 weeks. And even if you have a well-cooked chicken, you may have blood in the bones because these birds are so young. The bones have never had a chance to not have blood in them, whatever point that is. In any case, these are all very young chickens. And in theory, should be very tender. Some have more flavor than others. Some are more tender than others. I am finding that, you know, it being free range or pasture range, whatever fancy name they're going to attach to it, is sort of immaterial. I'm sure what they feed the chickens is very material.
Right.
And the good chickens these days are all fed only vegetarian feed. I don't even ask what was in the feed before it was all vegetarian. And Although I have to say that years ago, every once in a while, you'd get a chicken that tasted like anchovies.
Right.
So
it does taste. Its diet has an affect. One of the first
does everything, Jill. You know the old saying, "You are what you eat." No, you are what you eat. Eats. If you're eating, you know, animals, you have to know what you're.
Is eating, and I was going to tell you, and I learned this about chickens 50 years ago, but I learned that about you are what you eat about 50 years ago, because apparently it takes 7 years. If you go to a place, it takes 7 years for your inside, for your body to become that, let's just say, Sicilian. Because of what you eat, you have to eat the animals, etc., and the fruit of the and the herbs of the land, which are grown in the soil, and it's all very much part of it.
Okay, so we're moving on. You're going to buy a good chicken,
Okay. Whatever
you deem is a good chicken. We like a relatively tender chicken, but not a soft chicken. So I don't buy the major brands like Perdue. Although Perdue has a better line, I'm trying to think what they're called, something Harvest, and those are pretty good. Another brand that I like is called Smart Chicken. I recently got an excellent whole chicken from Whole Foods, and it was not their regular Whole Foods chicken. It was sort of a better branded chicken. I think they called it Prairie Raised or something like that. And came wrapped in plastic with the brand name. And,
from the prairie.
So it's like that. So now here's the deal. I have not roasted a whole chicken in many years because once I discovered spatchcocking, I love the word, which just basically means
bashing
butterfly
it in the
chicken, I find that is the ultimate way to roast a chicken. It's so much easier. You don't have to turn anything. Anyway, and here's what I do. So this is, I know I've done this on the air before, but as you told me the other day, we can do chicken, roast chicken 101 over and over again.
Exactly.
So it's a refresher course.
Right.
So to spatchcock or butterfly a chicken, you've got to cut out, to start, you've got to cut out the backbone. Now, the backbone is identified by the tushy. That's the bottom of the backbone. I think everybody knows what a chicken tushy looks like. It's a triangular fatty piece. And if you take, I use a very, very, very good scissors called a Joyce Chen scissors, which you can buy.
Good old Joyce Chen.
Good old Joyce Chen. Joyce has been gone for at least 30 years.
I have two, and people are not allowed to touch them.
And well, I have two pairs.
They will die. I will die with them being sharp still.
Well, no, mine, I just realized the other day when I was spatchcocking a chicken that it may be time to get a new pair, but mine must be at least 20 years old. Anyway, it worked, but with a little bit more difficulty than usual. I also have a very nice a poultry shears, but it doesn't work as well as those scissors do. Anyway, they cut through chicken bones. So starting on one side or the other of the tushy, you cut straight up to what would be the neck if the neck was still there. And then now you've cut along one side of the backbone, and now cut along the other side of the backbone, and don't throw it away. I roast it along with the butterfly chicken on the same sheet pan, and that's my chef's share. That I get to nibble that. Bob doesn't like nibbling on bony things anyway. But that really is delicious, and I eat it almost as soon as it comes out of the oven, even if I'm making the chicken ahead and serving it, you know, warm or at room temperature, which I do sometimes. Anyway, now that you have the chicken backbone out, you can spread the chicken out and either make a slit along the breastbone or just, it depending on the chicken, if this will work or not, just press down on the breasts so that they get flattened out, and your chicken is now laying flat on whatever surface you're on. I salt and pepper both sides very well. First, you know, just a lot of salt and pepper. And I bake mine on, or roast mine, on a rack. Not necessary. You can just line the sheet pan with foil for easier cleanup, if that's your goal, or not. And I have a rack that fits right inside my sheet pan. And I put the chicken spread out, of course, skin side up, and salt and pepper that, and then brush everything, including the back that I just put next to it, with olive oil. Now, you can season the chicken in many, many different ways, but basically all you really need is salt and pepper. One way that I like to change out sometimes is if I have sage, I can tuck sage leaves under the skin and marinate the chicken for, I don't know, a couple hours maybe, with lemon juice at room temperature, and then roast it. Or you can, I mean, people put other things
the
under the skin.
The possibilities are endless. It's so funny.
The possibilities are endless. Or you could not do it on a rack, which I do, but right on the sheet pan. And you could put slices of lemon on the sheet pan, which, by the way, is delicious once it's all cooked. I've done potatoes around the on a sheet pan. All that nice chicken
potatoes
fat
carrots,
is going to lubricate
onion, the whole thing.
Onion, you know. But mainly I just do chicken.
Okay.
Plain salt and pepper. And here's the instruction, which I have now played around with enough times to know that this works no matter what. 450 degrees, and you roast the chicken on the top. I told you to brush it with olive oil, right?
Right.
And you brush it with olive oil and then put it on the top shelf of your 450-degree preheated oven for, depending on the size, 40 to 45 minutes. Why I say top shelf of the oven is because that's where you get the most browning. The reflected heat of the top of the oven facilitates browning. And I do want a nicely browned, crisp-skinned chicken that is still very juicy under the skin. So 40 to 45, if it's a 4-pound chicken, leave it in for 45 minutes. If it's 3-pound something, 40 minutes is enough. And then I let it sit at room temperature out of the oven for at least 10 minutes before I cut up the chicken. And we eat the leg-thigh joint, one each, for a meal. And then I still by the way, I sometimes cheat. I don't take off the wing tips because I like to crunch on them.
Right.
And, yeah, not everybody does. But so if
yeah,
you don't.
Yeah, some people. One of the biggest treats more than 50 years ago was on Shabbos, was the chicken feet.
But this in this case, the wing tips get really crisp.
Yeah.
You know, in the 450 degree oven.
And now
you could take them off and not cook them at all.
They're not,
in any case, I sometimes cheat and eat that part too. But then we have at least one more meal out of this chicken.
Right.
Because I haven't touched the breast yet. This particular chicken that I cooked, the Whole Foods prairie raised or whatever they called it, had particularly juicy white meat. And I made a particularly good chicken salad with it on the next day, which was yesterday. And, in fact, we didn't finish the chicken salad, so we're going to get a snack meal out of the rest of it, meaning a small meal out of the rest of it. So that was really like three meals out of one chicken.
And that's
my problem with the rotisserie chickens is 99% of the time, in my experience, the breasts are overcooked and so dry that I don't care about them. So, and then there's the Costco, the famous Costco rotisserie chicken. I think it's the biggest selling and maybe biggest money losing item in all of Costco. I forget what silly low price it is, but it's very cheap. But as soon as I ate it, I said, something funny about this chicken. And it's pumped with something. I think they admit now that they do inject them
right.
with whatever. But whatever it is, I don't care for it. So I don't buy those chickens. My fancy supermarket around the corner makes rotisserie chickens, but and they're not expensive either, really. Not that expensive. But I don't know. They're always too dry for me. So I'm sticking by my method. 400, it's going to be on my tombstone, the recipe for spatchcock chicken, 450 degrees, 40 to 45 minutes. The other thing that's going to be on my tombstone is my recipe for brisket. Apropos, Wednesday night is the first night of Rosh Hashanah, and it's after St. Patrick's Day, when corned beef, which is made from brisket, is the most popular thing in America. This weekend, even though the Jews don't amount to 2 or 3% of the population, there's going to be a lot of brisket in the meat cases, and at least in the Northeast there is. So brisket is a tough one. I mean, it's a tough piece of meat, and it's a tough one to cook. And I always talk about my mother over the course of her life evolving her brisket recipe. And I just, Joan Nathan has a brisket recipe. I think it's in the Times this week. And she mentions how, you know, America went through various brisket eras. And my mother, the last straw with my mother was she made a brisket with Harvey's Bristol cream. Remember that, Harvey?
No, I never had.
I think it took a whole
bottle of Harvey's Bristol cream. Because my grandmother's brisket was the
whatever it was, we said, Ma, this is enough. No more. No more inventive briskets.
No.
And she went back to what my grandmother always made, which was for you need an almost a pound of onions per pound of meat, not quite. If you're cooking only what they call the first cut, which is the flat cut, which is the less fatty cut, which is what most Americans want to eat, I would definitely sear it first, and then put it, let's say it's a 5-pound piece of brisket, and then put it in a pan with at least 3 pounds of sliced onions, maybe a carrot or two sliced, a bay leaf or two, and then put your seared brisket on top. Cover it with foil. Actually, you should push the meat down into the onions a little bit, but cover it with foil, and it's going to take a minimum of 3 hours to get tender. At which point, it will, and no liquid in there. The onions will give off their sweet liquid, and the meat will give off its very delicious juices, and they'll all mingle. Did I say you have to salt and pepper the meat very well?
I hope so.
And then it'll be almost tender, and you can take it out of the oven. You can do this ahead. You take it out of the oven and let it cool, and then slice the meat and put it back in the pan with these now cooked down onions, and you put it back in the oven when you're ready to reheat it. Put it back in the oven without anything over it, no foil, no cover, no nothing, and it'll brown, and it will get even more tender, and that's my best advice for brisket. By the way, I made this for Martha Stewart once on her TV show.
What did he say?
And she credits me with the best brisket she ever ate. But who she really should credit is the butcher that she used, who is a butcher I use to this day. Very, very expensive butcher that delivers, DeBraga. Anybody, by the way, they will deliver anywhere. I don't know what they cost to deliver outside of the New York metro area, but I only pay $10 for a delivery, and it's DeBraga, DeBraga, and their meat's sensational. When I want to splurge, I buy steaks from DeBraga.
All right, so now I'm going to throw in my grandmother's brisket recipe, which does not have Harvey's Bristol cream, but has fewer steps.
What is it?
And our family. Unlike apparently most Americans, you want the plate, okay? You want the fat.
Oh yeah, no, you want the fat. In fact, let me just say before we get into that, if you don't mind, I when I cook a brisket, I really want to cook the whole brisket, which means that piece, the flat piece that I just described, and the large chunky piece that's attached to it on top by a big layer of fat. And that's, I call deckle. It's the second cut, or I think a triangular cut. It has different names, but it's the one that's very, very well marbled with fat. But I cook them all together and, without separating the two pieces, and then only separate it once it's all cooked. And meantime, the whole thing has been basted with this delicious fat, which you can always skim off in the end. Now,
so,
I'm sorry I interrupted you.
That's okay. It's a whatchamacallit, occupational hazard. plenty of salt, plenty of pepper. If you are in, she used to use, but bear in mind this is years ago, she would use onion salt as well. But I have since. You put the whole thing in a pan, you slice up some onions, not chopped, but, you know, rings.
Yeah.
Put them all across the, Hunt's tomato sauce.
Uh-huh.
Over the top, and then a bunch of onion rings. In that, which is always fun to stick them in there. And then cover it and stick it in the oven for, I don't know, a while.
3 hours anyway.
3 hours anyway, and before it is done, put in peeled potatoes around it.
Uh-huh.
And it comes out into... It doesn't taste like anything...
Let me tell you what it will taste like. My grandmother Rosie's pot roast, not my grandmother Elsie's pot roast.
But the
I
point
just
is,
described
cooked,
Elsie's
the
pot roast. Rosie
down,
had
so
tomato sauce in her pot roast.
Well, it cooks down, and then the what would otherwise be just kind of blah potatoes absorb a lot of the fat. Anyway, it's great.
Tell me.
And it's one step in it. Yum.
I made a meatloaf over the weekend, and the one thing I regret, it came out great. It came out so good that Bob said, oh, I don't even have to put ketchup on this. So it was very good meatloaf, but the one thing I regret is that I did not roast some potatoes around it, because the fat that came off of this meatloaf was so tasty. It would have been very well absorbed.
Exactly.
By some
potatoes. That's why you were laughing at that. And when I think of it, my grandmother's, as I have said for years, we've done the show for years. My mother was an indifferent cook, but her mother, you know, the meatloaf recipe was not dissimilar in that it had some tomato sauce on it.
There's nothing that isn't better with tomato sauce.
And
so
I
am going to make a little bit today
again,
and put on the leftover meatloaf, which didn't require it yesterday, but I think today might.
The leftover brisket, the leftover...
Leftover everything. I like leftovers because that means I don't have to cook.
I like leftovers.
Even though
I
love to cook.
But we used to
But I like a day off sometimes,
right,
too.
Right, of course.
So today I have leftover meatloaf. And also, well, anyway... We have this tiny bit of chicken salad still left. But I think the meat... And I have glorious end-of-season tomatoes. So we've been eating a lot of tomatoes the last few days. This may be the last gasp of tomatoes.
And then, I don't know how we are for time, but what are you doing for Rosh Hashanah? Anything?
It's a leading question. I'm not
just
sure.
Cooking or don't
probably,
you know yet?
Probably getting together with other friends that I asked this question of yesterday, and they said, "Oh, we hadn't thought about it yet." So
I'm just interested in the food component, but
I don't think I'm going to make. That's not true. I am making chicken soup today. I'm going to have the butcher deliver me a whole bunch of backs, and so very well, maybe we'll just. They'll just come over for soup with matzo balls and lakshin. Lakshin is fine egg noodles. And in the old delis, they sometimes, you could get your chicken soup with all known starchy additions, meaning a bowl of soup with a matzo ball, fine egg noodles, and maybe even a kreplach. Now, kreplach are traditional for Rosh Hashanah, for the new year. Did you know that?
No.
Do you know what kreplach are?
Of course.
Well, you do. Kreplach, for all of you who are wondering, are basically Jewish wonton. They're a noodle dough filled with generally shredded braised meat, and they're served in soup. However, they're also served fried. And there are wonton made with chopped meat, which is the quickie way, and that's the way I always used to make them until somebody asked me to make them the old-fashioned way, which is very, very good, of course. Anyway, that's kreplach. And years ago, I don't know, too many years ago, my family used to buy kreplach from a woman, I don't even know her name, we just called her the kreplach lady. And she was somebody in the neighborhood who was very good at making kreplach, which is a project. Even my grandmother, who loved cooking projects, didn't do kreplach very often. She did, but not that often. After she got tired of making kreplach, we used to buy them from the kreplach lady. It was like they were homemade kreplach. But the kreplach lady only sold them at Rosh Hashanah. So. It was a pop-up kreplach business.
What would now become pop-up kreplach?
In today's parlance,
say that three times fast. Pop-up kreplach. Pop-up kreplach. And if anybody is curious, kreplach.
Kreplach. H, yeah, kreplach. Jewish
wonton. Where are we for time? Speaking of kreplach,
we're ready to say everybody should have a happy, healthy New Year.
Well,
starts Wednesday night, September also means school supplies.
But it's October.
Yeah, just.
We have had in the past, because it totally depends on when the moon is, boys and girls, but we have had Rosh Hashanahs anywhere from early in September to, this is, I think, close to the latest it can be.
I think this could be the latest it could be, or
thereabouts. When it ventures into October.
Yeah. So anyway, spatchcock your chicken, just imprint this in your brain, 450 degrees for 40 minutes. It works. Okay. Top shelf of the oven. It'll brown if you baste it but if you just brush it with some olive oil, it'll get nice and crisp and brown and juicy. All you want from a rotisserie chicken, but more.
But right there, and you don't even have to go to the store.
That's it. Take care, everybody, and when I talk to you next, it'll be a new year, and Jill will know the date. I don't know.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Happy New Year, and thank you very much, Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, on Robin Hood Radio.